covered with bulletin boards, maps, and engineering charts. The far wall was glass and overlooked the assembly line. 5 men in ties and shirt sleeves were there, a secretary with a notepad, and John Martyr wearing a blue suit. She was surprised he was here. The COO rarely chaired IRTs. In person, Martyr was dark, intense, in his mid-40s with slicked-back hair. He looked like a cobra about to strike. Casey said, "This is my new assistant, Bob Richman." Martyr stood up and said, "Bob, welcome," and shook the kid's hand. He gave a rare smile. Apparently Martyr, with his finely tuned sense of corporate politics, was ready to fawn over any Norton family member, even a nephew on loan. It made Casey wonder if this kid was more important than she thought he was. Martyr introduced Richman to the others at the table. "Doug Daugherty, in charge of structure and mechanical." He gestured to an overweight man of 45, with a pot belly, bad complexion, and thick glasses. Daugherty lived in a state of perpetual gloom. He spoke in a mournful monotone and could always be counted on to report that everything was bad and getting worse. Today he wore a checked shirt and striped tie. He must have gotten out of the house before his wife saw him. Daugherty gave Richman a sad, thoughtful nod. "Nguyen Van Trung, Avionics." Trung was 30, trim and quiet, self-contained. Casey liked him. The Vietnamese were the hardest-working people at the plant. The avionics guys were MIS specialists involved with the aircraft computer programs. They represented the new wave at Norton, younger, better educated, better manners. "Ken Byrne, power plant." Ken was red-haired and freckled, his chin thrust forward, ready to fight. Notoriously profane and abusive, he was known in the plant as Easy Byrne because of his quick temper. "Ron Smith, electrical." Bald and timid, nervously fingering pens in his pocket. Ron was extremely competent. It often seemed he carried the schematics for the aircraft around in his head. But he was painfully shy. He lived with his invalid mother in Pasadena. "Mike Lee, who represents the carrier." A well-dressed man of 50, gray hair cropped short, in a blue blazer with a striped tie. Mike was a former Air Force pilot, a retired one-star general. He was Trans-Pacific's rep at the plant. "And Barbara Ross with the notepad." The IRT secretary was in her 40s and overweight. She glared at Casey with open hostility. Casey ignored her. Martyr waved the kid to a seat and Casey sat down beside him. "First item," Martyr said. "Casey is now liaising QA to the IRT. Considering the way she handled the RTO at DFW, she'll be our press spokesman from now on. Any questions?" Richman looked bewildered, shaking his head. Martyr turned to him and explained, "Singleton did a good job with the press on a rejected takeoff at Dallas-Fort Worth last month, so she'll handle any press inquiries we get. Okay? We all on the same page? Let's get started. Barbara?" The secretary handed around stapled packets of paper. "Trans-Pacific Flight 545, Martyr said, and N-22, fuse number 271. Flight originated at Kai Tak, Hong Kong at 2200 hours yesterday. Uneventful takeoff, uneventful flight until approximately 0500 hours this morning, when the aircraft encountered what the pilot described as severe turbulence." There were groans throughout the room. "Turbulence?" The engineers shook their heads. "Severe turbulence producing extreme pitch excursions in flight." "Ah, Christ," Byrne said. "The aircraft," Martyr continued, "made an emergency landing at LAX and medical units were on hand. Our preliminary report indicates 56 injured and 3 dead." "Oh, that's very bad," Doug Daugherty said in a sad monotone, blinking behind his thick glasses. "I suppose this means we've got the NTSB on our backs," he said. Casey leaned over to Richman and whispered, "National Transportation Safety Board usually gets involved when there are fatalities." "Not in this case," Martyr said. "This is a foreign carrier, and the incident occurred in international airspace. NTSB has its hands full with the Columbia crash. We think they're going to pass on this one." "Turbulence," Kenny Byrne said, snorting. "Is there any confirmation?" "No," Martyr said. The plane was at 37,000 feet when the incident took place. No other aircraft at that altitude and position reported weather problems.
Satellite weather maps? Casey said.
Coming.
What about the passengers? She said. Did the captain make an announcement? Was the seatbelt sign on?
Nobody's interviewed the passengers yet, but our preliminary information suggests no announcement was made.
Richmond was looking bewildered again. Casey scribbled a note on her yellow pad, tilted it so he could read, "No turbulence."
Trung said, "Have we debriefed the pilot?"
"No,"
Martyr said.
"The flight crew caught a connecting flight out and left the country."
"Oh, great," Kenny Burns said, throwing his pencil on the table. "Just great. We got a damn hit and run."
"Hold on now," Mike Lee said in a cool tone. "On behalf of the carrier, I think we have to recognize the flight crew acted responsibly. They have no liability here, but they face possible litigation from the civil aviation authorities in Hong Kong, and they went home to deal with it."
Casey wrote, "Flight crew unavailable."
"Do, we know who the captain was?" Ron Smith asked timidly.
"We do," Mike Lee said. He consulted a leather notebook.
"His name is John Chang, 45 years old, resident of Hong Kong, 6,000 hours experience. He's Trans-Pacific's senior pilot for the N-22. Very skilled."
"Oh, yeah?" Burns said, leaning forward across the table. "And when was he last recertified?"
3 months ago."
"Where?"
"Right here," Mike Lee said. "On Norton flight simulators by Norton instructors."
Burns sat back, snorting unhappily.
"Do we know how he was rated?" Casey asked.
"Outstanding," Lee said. "You can check your records."
Casey wrote, "Not human error, ?
Martyr said to Lee,
"Do you think we can get an interview with him, Mike? Will he talk to our service rep at Kai Tak?"
"I'm sure the crew will cooperate," Lee said. "Especially if you submit written questions. I'm sure I can get them answered within 10 days.
"Hmm," Martyr said, distressed. "That long."
"Unless we get a pilot interview," Van Trung said, "we may have a problem. The incident occurred 1 hour prior to landing. The cockpit voice recorder only stores the last 25 minutes of conversation. So, in this case, the CVR is useless."
"True, but you still have the FDR.
Casey wrote, "Flight data recorder."
"Yes, we have the FDR, Trung said.
But this clearly didn't assuage his concerns, and Casey knew why. Flight recorders were notoriously unreliable. In the media, they were the mysterious black boxes that revealed all the secrets of a flight, but in reality they often didn't work.
"I'll do what I can," Mike Lee promised.
Casey said, "What do we know about the aircraft?"
"Aircraft's brand new," Martyr said. 3 years service. It's got 4,000 hours and 900 cycles.
Casey wrote, "Cycles equals takeoffs and landings."
"What about inspections?" Doherty asked gloomily. "I suppose we'll have to wait weeks for the records."
"It had a C-check in March."
"Where?"
"LAX."
"So maintenance was probably good," Casey said.
"Correct," Martyr said. "As a first cut, we can't attribute this to weather, human factors, or maintenance. So we're in the trenches. Let's run the fault tree. Did anything about this aircraft cause behavior that looks like turbulence? Structural?"
"Oh, sure," Doherty said miserably. "A slats deploy would do it. We'll function hydraulics on all the control surfaces."
"Avionics?"
Trung was scribbling notes.
"Right now, I'm wondering why the autopilot didn't override the pilot. Soon as I get the FDR download, I'll know more."
"Electrical?"
"It's possible we got a slats deploy from a sneak circuit," Ron Smith said, shaking his head. "I mean, it's possible."
"Power plant?"
"Yeah, power plant could be involved," Burns said, running his hand through his red hair. "The thrust reversers could have deployed in flight. That'd make the plane nose over and roll. But if the reverser's deployed, there'll be residual damage. We'll check the sleeves."
Casey looked down at her pad. She had written, "Structural, slats deploy. Hydraulics, slats deploy. Avionics, autopilot. Electrical, sneak circuit. Power plant, thrust reversers." That was basically every system on the aircraft.
"You've got a lot of ground to cover," Martyr said, standing and gathering his papers together. "Don't let me keep you."
Oh, hell, Burns said. We'll nail this in a month, John. I'm not worried.
I am, Marta said, because we don't have a month. We have a week.
Cries around the table.
A week?
Jeez, John.
Come on, John. You know an IRT always takes a month.
Not this time, Marta said.
Last Thursday, our President Hal Edgerton received an LOI from Beijing government to purchase 50 N-22s, with an option for another 30. First delivery in 18 months.
There was stunned silence.
The men all looked at each other. A big China sale had been rumored for months. The deal had been reported as imminent in various news accounts. But nobody at Norton really believed it.
It's true, Marta said. And I don't need to tell you what that means. It's an $8 billion order from the fastest-growing airframe market in the world. It's 4 years of full-capacity production. It'll put this company on solid financial footing into the 21st century. It'll fund development for the N-22 stretch and the advanced NXX widebody.
Hal and I agree. This sale means the difference between life and death for the company.
Marta placed the papers in his briefcase and snapped it shut.
I fly to Beijing Sunday to join Hal and sign the letter of intent with the Minister of Transport. He's going to want to know what happened to Flight 545. And I better be able to tell him, or he'll turn around and sign with Airbus. In which case, I'm in deep shit, this company is in deep shit, and everybody at this table is out of a job. The future of Norton Aircraft is riding on this investigation, so I don't want to hear anything but answers. And I want them inside a week. See you tomorrow.
He turned on his heel and walked out of the room.
War Room, 7:27 a.m.
What an asshole, Burns said. This is his idea of motivating the troops?
Fuck him.
Trung shrugged.
It's the way he always is.
What do you think? Smith said. I mean, this could be great, great news. Has Edgerton really got an LOI from China?
I bet he does, Trung said, because the plant's been quietly gearing up. They've made another set of tools to fab the wing. The tools are about to be shipped to Atlanta. I'll bet he's got a deal.
What he's got, said Byrne, is a major case of cover my ass.
Meaning?
Edgerton might have a tentative from Beijing, but $8 billion is a big order from a big gorilla. Boeing, Douglas, and Airbus are all chasing that order. The Chinese could give it to any of them at the last minute. That's their style. They do it all the time. So Edgerton's shitting rivets, worrying he won't close the deal, and he'll have to tell the board he lost the big one. So what does he do? He lays it on Martyr. And what does Martyr do?
Makes it our fault, Trung said.
Right. This TPA flight puts them in perfect position. If they close with Beijing, they're heroes. But if the deal falls apart,
it's because we blew it, Trung said.
Right. We're the reason an $8 billion deal cratered.
Well, Trung said, standing,
I think we better look at that plane.
Administration, 9:12 a.m. Harold Edgerton, the newly appointed president of Norton Aircraft, was in his office on the 10th floor staring out the window overlooking the plant when John Martyr walked in. Edgerton was a big man, an ex-fullback, with a ready smile and cold, watchful eyes. He had previously worked at Boeing and had been brought in 3 months earlier to improve Norton's marketing. Edgerton turned and frowned at Martyr.
This is a hell of a mess, he said. How many died?
Three, Martyr said.
Christ, Edgerton said. He shook his head. Of all the times for this to happen, did you brief the investigation team on the LOI? Tell them how urgent this is?
I briefed them.
And you'll clear it up this week.
I'm chairing the group myself. I'll get it done, Martyr said.
What about press?
Edgerton was still worried.
I don't want media relations handling this one. Benson's a drunk, the reporters all hate him, and the engineers can't do it. They don't speak English, for Christ's sake.
I've got it handled, Hal.
You do? I don't want you talking to the fucking press. You're grounded.
I understand, Martyr said. I've arranged for Singleton to do the press.
Singleton? The QA woman? Edgerton said. I looked at that tape you gave me where she talked to the reporters about the Dallas thing. She's pretty enough. but she comes off as a straight arrow.
Well, that's what we want, isn't it?
Marta said. We want honest, all-American, no-nonsense. And she's good on her feet, Hal.
She better be, Edgerton said. If the shit hits the fan, she has to perform.
She will, Marta said.
I don't want anything to undermine this China deal.
Nobody does, Hal.
Edgerton looked at Marta thoughtfully for a moment. Then he said, You better be real clear about that, he said, because I don't give a damn who you're married to. If this deal doesn't close, a lot of people are going to get taken out, not just me. A lot of other heads will roll.
I understand, Marta said.
You pick the woman, she's your call. The board knows it. If anything goes wrong with her or the IRT, you're out in your ass.
Nothing will go wrong, Marta said. It's under control.
It damn well better be,
Edgerton said, and turned away again to look out the window.
Marta left the room.
LAX Maintenance, Hangar 21, 9:48 a.m. The blue minivan crossed the runway and raced toward the line of maintenance hangars at Los Angeles Airport. From the rear of the nearest hangar, the yellow tail of the Trans-Pacific widebody protruded, its emblem shining in the sun. The engineers began to talk excitedly as soon as they saw the plane. The minivan rolled into the hangar and came to a stop beneath the wing. The engineers piled out. The RAMS team was already at work, a half-dozen mechanics up on the wing, wearing harnesses, scrabbling on their hands and knees.
"Let's do it!" Byrne shouted as he climbed a ladder to the wing. He made it sound like a battle cry.
The other engineers scrambled up after him. Daugherty followed last, climbing the ladder with a dejected air. Casey stepped out of the van with Richmond.
"They all go right to the wing," Richmond said.
"That's right." The wing's the most important part of an aircraft and the most complicated structure. They'll look at it first, then do a visual inspect on the rest of the exterior. This way?
Where are we going?
Inside. Casey walked to the nose, climbed a roll-in staircase to the forward cabin door just behind the cockpit. As she came to the entrance, she smelled the nauseating odor of vomit.
Jesus,
Richmond said behind her. Casey went inside. She knew the forward cabin would have the least damage, but even here some of the seat backs were broken. Armrests had torn free and swung into the aisles. Overhead luggage bins were cracked, the doors hanging open. Oxygen masks dangled from the ceiling, some missing. There was blood on the carpet, blood on the ceiling, puddles of vomit on the seats.
"My God," Richmond said, covering his nose.
He looked pale.
"This happened because of turbulence?"
No, she said. Almost certainly not.
Then why would the pilot...
We don't know yet, she said. Casey went forward to the flight deck. The cockpit door was latched open and the flight deck appeared normal. All the logs and paperwork were missing. A tiny infant's shoe was on the floor. Bending to look at it, she noticed a mass of crumpled black metal wedged beneath the cockpit door. A video camera. She pulled it free... And it broke apart in her hands, an untidy heap of circuit boards, silver motors, and loops of tape hanging from a cracked cassette. She gave it to Richmond.
What do I do with this?
Keep it. Casey headed aft, knowing it would be worse in the back. Already she was forming a picture in her mind of what had happened on this flight. There's no question, this aircraft underwent severe pitch oscillations. That's when the plane noses up and down. She explained.
How do you know? Richmond said.
Because that's what makes passengers vomit. They can take yaw and roll, but pitching makes them puke.
Why are the oxygen masks missing? Richmond said.
People grabbed them as they fell, she said. It must have happened that way. And the seat backs are broken. Do you know how much force it takes to break an airplane seat? They're designed to withstand an impact of 16 G's. People in this cabin bounced around like dice in a cup. And from the damage, it looks like it went on for a while.
How long?
At least 2 minutes, she said. An eternity for an incident like this, she thought. Passing a shattered midships galley, they came into the center of the cabin. Here, damage was much worse. Many seats were broken. There was a broad swath of blood across the ceiling. The aisles were covered with debris, shoes, torn clothing, children's toys. A cleanup crew in blue uniforms marked Norton IRT was collecting the personal belongings, putting them into big plastic bags. Casey turned to a woman. "Have you found any cameras?"
5 or 6 so far," the woman said. "Couple of video cameras. There's all sorts of stuff here."
She reached under a seat, came out with a brown rubber diaphragm.
"Like I said."
Stepping carefully over the litter in the aisles, Casey moved farther aft. She pressed another divider and entered the aft cabin near the tail. Richmond sucked in his breath. It looked as if a giant hand had smashed the interior. Seats were crushed flat. Overhead bins hung down, almost touching the floor. Ceiling panels had split apart, exposing wiring and silver insulation. There was blood everywhere. Some of the seats were soaked deep maroon. The aft lavs were ripped apart, mirrors shattered, stainless steel drawers hanging open, twisted. Casey's attention was drawn to the left of the cabin, where 6 paramedics were struggling to hold a heavy shape, wrapped in white nylon mesh that hung near a ceiling bin. The paramedics adjusted their position, the nylon webbing shifted, and suddenly a man's head flopped out of the mesh. The face gray, mouth open, eyes sightless, wisps of hair dangling.
"Oh, God," Richmond said. He turned and fled.
Casey went over to the paramedics. The corpse was a middle-aged Chinese man.
"What's the problem here?" she said.
"Sorry, ma'am," one of the medics said, "but we can't get him out. We found them wedged here, and he's stuck pretty good, his left leg."
One of the paramedics shined a light upward. The left leg was jammed through the overhead bin into the silver insulation above the window panel. She tried to remember what cabling ran there, whether it was flight critical.
"Just be careful cutting him out," she said.
From the galley, she heard a cleanup woman say,
"Strangest damn thing I ever saw."
Another woman said,
"How'd it get here?"
"Damned if I know, honey."
Casey went over to see what they were talking about. The cleaning woman was holding a blue pilot's cap. It had a bloody footprint on the top. Casey reached for it.
"Where'd you find this?"
"Right here," the cleaning woman said.
"Outside the aft galley. Long way from the cockpit, isn't it?"
"Yes." Casey turned the cap in her hands. Silver wings on the front, the yellow Trans-Pacific medallion in the center. It was a pilot's cap, with a stripe for a captain, so it probably belonged to one of the backup crew. If this plane carried a backup crew, she didn't know that yet.
"Oh, dear me, this is awful, just awful."
She heard the distinctive monotone and looked up to see Doug Daugherty, the structural engineer, striding into the aft cabin.
"Why did they do this to my beautiful airplane?" he moaned. Then he saw Casey. "You know what this is, don't you? It's not turbulence. They were porpoising."
"Maybe," Casey said.
Porpoising was the term for a series of dives and climbs, like a porpoise leaping in water.
"Oh, yes," Daugherty said gloomily. "That's what happened. They lost control. Terrible, just terrible."
One of the paramedics said,
"Mr. Daugherty?" Daugherty looked over. "Oh, don't tell me," he said. "This is where the guy got wedged?" "Yes, sir."
"Wouldn't you know,"
he said gloomily, moving closer.
"It had to be the aft bulkhead, right where every flight critical system comes together to... Okay, let me see. What is it, his foot?"
"Yes, sir."
They shone the light for him. Daugherty pushed up against the body, which swayed in the harness.
"Can you hold him? Okay. Anybody got a knife or something? You probably don't, but..."
One of the paramedics gave him a pair of scissors, and Daugherty began to cut. Bits of silver insulation floated to the ground. Daugherty cut again and again, his hand moving quickly. Finally, he stopped.
"Okay, he missed the A-59 cable run. He missed the A-47 cable run. He's left of the hydraulic lines, left of the avionics pack. Okay, I can't see he hurt the plane in any way."
The paramedics holding the dead body stared at Daugherty. One of them said,
"Can we cut him out, sir?"
Daugherty was still looking intently.
"What? Oh, yeah, sure, cut him out." He stepped back, and the paramedics applied the big metal jaws to the upper portion of the plane. They wedged the jaws between the overhead luggage bins and the ceiling, then opened them. There was a loud cracking sound as the plastic broke. Dougherty turned away.
"I can't watch," he said. "I can't watch them tear up my beautiful aircraft."
He headed back to the nose. The paramedics stared as he left. Richmond came back, looking slightly embarrassed. He pointed out the windows. "What are those guys doing on the wing?" Casey bent down, looked through the windows at the engineers on the wing. "They're inspecting the slats," she said. "Leading-edge control surfaces."
"And what do slats do?"
"You'll have to start him from the beginning." Casey said, "You know anything about aerodynamics, no?"
"Well, an aircraft flies because of the shape of the wing."
The wing looked simple, she explained, but it was actually the most complicated physical component of the aircraft, and it took the longest to build. By comparison, the fuselage, was simple, just a lot of round barrels riveted together, and the tail was just a fixed vertical vane with control surfaces. But a wing was a work of art, nearly 200 feet long. It was incredibly strong, capable of bearing the weight of the plane, but at the same time precisely shaped to within 1/100 of an inch. "The shape," Casey said, "is what's crucial. It's curved on top, flat on the bottom. That means air going across the top of the wing has to move faster. And because of Bernoulli's principle..."
"I went to law school," he reminded her.
"Bernoulli's principle says the faster a gas moves, the lower its pressure. So the pressure within a moving stream is less than the air surrounding it," she said. "Since air moves faster across the top of the wing, it creates a vacuum which sucks the wing upward. The wing is strong enough to support the fuselage, so the whole plane is lifted up. That's what makes a plane fly."
"Okay."
"Now, two factors determine how much lift is created: the speed the wing moves through the air, and the amount of curvature. The greater the curvature, the greater the lift."
"Okay."
"When the wing is moving fast during flight, going maybe 0.8 Mach, it doesn't need much curvature. It actually wants to be almost flat. But when the aircraft is moving slower during takeoff and landing, the wing needs greater curvature to maintain lift. So at those times, we increase the curvature by extending sections in the front and back. Flaps at the back, and slats at the leading edge."
"Slats are like flaps, but in the front?"
"Right."
"I never noticed them before," Richmond said, looking out the window.
"Smaller planes don't have them," Casey said. "But this aircraft weighs close to 750,000 pounds, fully loaded. You've got to have slats on a plane this size." As they watched, the first of the slats moved outward, then tilted down. The men on the wing stuck their hands in their pockets and watched. Richmond said, "Why are the slats so important?"
"Because," Casey said, "one possible cause of turbulence is slat extension in mid-flight. Remember, at cruise speed, the wing should be almost flat. If the slats extend, the plane may become unstable."
"And what would make the slats extend?"
"Pilot error," Casey said. "That's the usual cause."
"But supposedly this plane had a very good pilot."
"Right, supposedly.
And if it wasn't pilot error?"
She hesitated.
"There is a condition called uncommanded slats deployment. It means the slats extend without warning, all by themselves."
Richmond frowned.
"Can that happen?"
"It's been known to occur," she said. "But we don't think it's possible on this aircraft." She wasn't going to get into details with this kid, not now.
Richmond still frowned. "If it's not possible, why are they checking?"
"Because it might have happened, and our job is to check everything. Maybe there's a problem with this particular aircraft. Maybe the control cables aren't properly rigged. Maybe there's an electrical fault in the hydraulics actuators. Maybe the proximity sensors failed. Maybe the avionics code is buggy. We'll check every system until we find out what happened and why. And right now, we haven't got a clue."
4 men were squeezed into the cockpit, hunched over the controls. Van Trung, who was certified for the aircraft, sat in the captain's seat. Kenny Byrne was in the first officer's seat on the right. Trung was functioning the control surfaces one after another. Flaps, slats, elevators, rudder. With each test, the flight deck instrumentation was verified visually. Casey stood outside the cockpit with Richmond. She said, "You got anything, Van?"
"Nothing yet," Trung said.
"We've got diddly squat," Ken Byrne said. "This bird is cherry. There's nothing wrong with this plane."
Richmond said, "Then maybe turbulence caused it after all."
"Turbulence my ass," Byrne said. "Who said that? Is that the kid?"
"Yes," Richmond said.
"Straighten the kid out, Casey," Byrne said, glancing over his shoulder.
"Turbulence," Casey said to Richmond, "is a famous catch-all for anything that goes wrong on the flight deck. Turbulence certainly occurs, and in the old days, planes had some rough times. But these days, turbulence bad enough to cause injuries is unusual.
Because..." "Radar, pal," Byrne snapped. "Commercial aircraft are all equipped with weather radar. Pilots can see weather formations ahead and avoid them. They've also got much better communications between aircraft. If a plane hits rough weather at your flight level 200 miles ahead of you, you'll hear about the signet and get a course change. So the days of serious turbulence are over."
Richmond was annoyed by Byrne's tone.
"I don't know," he said. "I've been on planes where turbulence got pretty rough. Ever seen anybody get killed on one of those planes?" "Well, no." "Seen people thrown from their seats?" "No." "Seen injuries of any kind?"
"No," Richmond said. "I haven't."
"That's right," Byrne said. "But surely it's possible that..."
"Possible?" Byrne said. "You mean like in court where anything is possible?"
"No, but you're a lawyer, right?"
"Yes, I am, but..."
"Well, you better get one thing straight right now. We're not doing law here. Law's a bunch of bullshit. This is an aircraft. It's a machine. And either something happened to this machine or it didn't. It's not a matter of opinion. So why don't you shut the fuck up and let us work?"
Richmond winced, but he didn't back down.
"Fine," he said. "But if it wasn't turbulence, there'll be evidence."
"That's right," Byrne said. "The seatbelt sign. Pilot hits turbulence, the first thing he does is flash the seatbelt sign and make an announcement. Everybody buckles up and nobody gets hurt. This guy never made an announcement."
"Maybe the sign doesn't work."
"Look up."
With a ping, the seatbelt sign came on above their heads.
"Maybe the announcement doesn't..."
Byrne's amplified voice said,
"Working, working, you better believe it's working."
The PA clicked off. Dan Green, the chubby operations inspector from the FSDO, came on board, puffing from the climb up the metal stairs.
"Hey, guys, I got your certificate to ferry the plane to Burbank. I figured you want to take the bird to the plant."
"Yeah, we do," Casey said.
"Hey, Dan," Kenny Byrne called. "Nice job keeping the flight crew here."
"Fuck you," Green said. "I had my guy at the gate a minute after the plane arrived. The crew was already gone."
He turned to Casey.
"They get the stiff out?"
"Not yet, Dan. He's wedged in pretty tight."
"We got the other dead bodies off and sent the seriously injured to Westside hospitals. Here's the list."
He handed a sheet of paper to Casey.
"Only a few are still at the port infirmary."
Casey said, "How many are still here?"
6 or 7, including a couple of stewardesses."
Casey said, "Can I talk to them?"
"I don't see why not," Green said.
Casey said, "Van, how much longer?"
"Figure an hour minimum."
"Okay," she said. "I'm gonna take the car."
"And take fucking Clarence Darrow with you," Byrne said.
LAX, 10:42 a.m. Driving in the van, Richmond gave a long exhale.
"Jeez," he said.
"Are they always so friendly?"
Casey shrugged. "They're engineers," she said. She was thinking, what did he expect? He must have dealt with engineers at GM. "Emotionally, they're all 13 years old, stuck at the age just before boys stop playing with toys because they've discovered girls. They're all still playing with toys. They have poor social skills, dress badly, but they're extremely intelligent and well-trained, and they are very arrogant in their way. Outsiders are definitely not allowed to play."
"Especially lawyers."
anybody. They're like chess masters. They don't waste time with amateurs. And they're under a lot of pressure now.
You're not an engineer?
Me? No. And I'm a woman. And I'm from QA. Three reasons why I don't count. Now, Martyr's made me IRT liaison to the press, which is another strike. The engineers all hate the press.
Will there be press on this?
Probably not, she said. It's a foreign carrier. Foreigners died. The incident didn't occur in the United States. And they don't have visuals. They won't pay any attention.
But it seems so serious.
Serious isn't a criterion, she said. Last year, there were 25 accidents involving substantial airframe damage. 23 occurred overseas. Which ones do you remember?
Richmond frowned.
The crash in Abu Dhabi that killed 56 people, Casey said. The crash in Indonesia that killed 200? Bogota that killed 153? You remember any of those?
No,
Richmond said.
But wasn't there something in Atlanta?
That's right, she said. A DC-9 in Atlanta. How many people were killed?
None.
How many were injured?
None.
Why do you remember it?
Because there was film at 11.
The van left the runway, went through the chain-link gate, and out onto the street. They turned onto Sepulveda and headed toward the rounded blue contours of the Sentinella Hospital.
Anyway, Casey said, we have other things to worry about now. She handed Richmond a tape recorder, clipped a microphone to his lapel, and told him what they were going to do. Sentinella Hospital, 12:06 p.m.
You want to know what happened?
The bearded man said in an irritable voice. His name was Bennett. He was 40 years old, a distributor for Guess Jeans. He had gone to Hong Kong to visit the factory. He went 4 times a year and always flew trans-Pacific. Now he was sitting up in bed in one of the curtained-off infirmary cubicles. His head and right arm were bandaged.
The plane almost crashed, that's what happened.
I see, Casey said. I was wondering if...
Who the hell are you people anyway?
He said. She handed him her card, introduced herself again.
Norton Aircraft? What do you have to do with it?
We build the airplane, Mr. Bennett.
That piece of shit? Fuck you, lady.
He threw the card back at her.
Get the fuck out of here, both of you.
Mr. Bennett.
Go on, get out, get out!
Outside the curtained cubicle, Casey looked at Richmond. I have a way with people, she said ruefully. Casey went to the next cubicle and paused. Behind the curtain, she heard Chinese being spoken rapidly, first a woman's voice and then a man's voice responding. She decided to move on to the next bed. She opened the curtains and saw a sleeping Chinese woman in a plaster neck brace. A nurse in the room looked up, held her finger to her lips. Casey went on to the next cubicle. It was one of the flight attendants, a 28-year-old woman named Kay Liang. She had a large abrasion on her face and neck, the skin raw and red. She sat in a chair by the empty bed, thumbing through a 6-month-old issue of Vogue. She explained that she had remained in the hospital to stay with Sha Yan Hao, another stewardess who was in the next cubicle. She is my cousin, she said. I'm afraid she was hurt badly. They will not let me be in the room with her. She spoke English well, with a British accent. When Casey introduced herself, Kay Liang looked confused. You're from the manufacturer, she said, but a man was just here.
What man?
A Chinese man. He was here a few minutes ago.
I don't know about that, Casey said, frowning,
but we'd like to ask you some questions.
Of course.
She put the magazine aside, folded her hands in her lap, composed. How long have you been with Trans-Pacific? Casey asked.
3 years, Kay Liang answered, and before that 3 years with Cathay Pacific. She always flew international routes, she explained, because she had languages, English and French, as well as Chinese.
And where were you when this incident occurred?
In the mid-cabin galley, just behind business class.
The flight attendants were preparing breakfast, she explained. It was about 5 a.m., perhaps a few minutes later.
And what happened?
The plane began to climb, she said. I know that because I was setting out drinks and they started to slide off the trolley. Then almost immediately there was a very steep descent.
What did you do?
She could do nothing, she explained, except hold on. The descent was steep. All the food and drinks fell.
She thought the descent lasted about 10 seconds, but she wasn't sure. Then there was another climb, extremely steep, and then another steep descent. On the second descent, she struck her head against the bulkhead.
Did you lose consciousness? No, but that was when I scraped my face.
She gestured to her injury. And what happened next?
She was not sure, she said. She was confused because the second stewardess in the galley, Miss Zhao, fell against her, and they were both knocked to the floor. We could hear the cries of the passengers, she said, and of course we saw them in the aisles.
Afterward, she said, the plane became level again. She was able to get up and help the passengers. The situation was very bad, she said, particularly aft.
Many injured and many bleeding in pain. The flight attendants were overwhelmed. Also, Miss Howell, my cousin, was not conscious. She had been in the aft galley. This upset the other stewardesses. And 3 passengers were dead. The situation was very distressing.
What did you do?
I got the emergency medical kits to care for the passengers. Then I went to the cockpit.
She wanted to see if the flight crew was all right.
And I wanted to tell them the first officer had been injured in the aft galley.
The first officer was in the aft galley when the incident occurred,
Casey said. Kay Leong blinked. Of the relief crew, yes.
Not the flight crew.
No, the first officer of the relief crew.
You had 2 crews on board?
Yes. When did the crews change? Perhaps 3 hours earlier, during the night.
What was the name of the injured first officer? Casey asked.
Again, she hesitated. I'm not sure. I had not flown with the relief crew before.
I see. And when you went to the cockpit?
Captain Chang had the plane in control. The crew was shaken, but not injured. Captain Chang told me that he had requested an emergency landing at Los Angeles.
You've flown with Captain Chang before?
Yes, he's a very good captain, excellent captain. I like him very much.
Protesting too much, Casey thought. The stewardess, previously calm, now appeared uneasy.
Liang glanced at Casey, then looked away. Did there appear to be any damage to the flight deck? Casey asked.
The stewardess frowned, thinking.
No, she said. The flight deck appeared normal in every respect.
Did Captain Chang say anything else?
Yes, he said they had an uncommanded slats deployment, she said. He said that had caused the upset, and the situation was now under control.
Uh-oh, Casey thought. This was not going to make the engineers happy. But Casey was troubled by the stewardess's technical phrasing. She thought it unlikely that a flight attendant would know about uncommanded slats deployment. But perhaps she was just repeating what the captain had said.
Did Captain Chang say why the slats deployed? He just said, uncommanded slats deployment.
I see, Casey said. And do you know where the slats control is located? Kay Liang nodded.
It is a lever in the center pillar between the chairs.
That was correct, Casey thought.
Did you notice the lever at that time, while you were in the cockpit?